Katie, the Bells have got new tunes.
Ah, later stage of the saga. What are they playing these days?
They have a different tune every quarter of the hour. And it's always a bit of a challenge when the tunes change to try and work out what they are, because they often don't sound anything like the song itself. But we've worked out that quarter two is Depeche Mode's Enjoy the Silence. And nice. I actually think it's an affront.
To Depeche Mode?
To Depeche Mode, but also to us. It's like saying, haha, enjoy the silence. The irony of having a song called Enjoy the Silence when there's this horrific noise ringing in my ears.
Oh. Depeche Mode are from my neck of the woods.
Are they?
Mm. Basildon.
No way.
Local pride. Feel like I'm responsible somehow.
How's everything in London?
Good, thank you. This was the week where I really leaned into all of the lockdown cliches. So
shaved your head.
Shaved my head. Not yet, but I feel like that's next. No, didn't shave my head, but I have made my own pastry and learned a dance routine on TikTok.
No way. What dance routine did you learn?
It's a baby shark one. If I manage to perfect it, I might post it on our Instagram.
I really wanted to download TikTok, but my husband banned me from downloading it because of how evil a company it is.
Oh.
His words, not mine. Don't sue us.
But there's those of dance routines and it's fun and it makes me feel young.
I know. They've been placed under investigation by the Netherlands this week.
Have they?
Yeah.
What for?
It's over child privacy.
Ah.
Child privacy safety.
I can see that that would be an issue. But that aside, the dance routines are great. So I've been doing that. And also, the third thing in the lockdown cliche triple is that I'm gearing up to host a quiz with you, which is very exciting.
Yes, that has become a lockdown cliche, hasn't it? But a fun one, I think. And I'm really looking forward to it. We're going to be hosting a pub quiz for our Patreon supporters twice this week, in fact, on Thursday evening and Saturday afternoon, European time. We're really looking forward to meeting all of you Patreon people over Zoom and anyone else who fancies signing up as a Patreon supporter before then, please do.
The more the merrier. If you fancy joining, you can chip in as little as $2 a month to keep this podcast running. And all of these contributions, well, they've been like massively helpful to Dominic and I in these straitened times. The newest of the amazing people to sign up are Venus Wu, who's a friend of mine. Thank you so much, Venus. Robin Schulze-Waldrup and Vilius Shuginis. And Vilius, I'm pretty sure your name is Lithuanian. And as we all know, despite my love of the city of Vilnius, my Lithuanian pronunciation is not my strong point. So apologies for that.
And we also just got a woman called Monica signing up to support us, which you may not have seen, Katie, but it was just before we went to record. So thank you, Monica.
Thank you, Monica. How are you doing?
I'm fine, although I did just read a really depressing report about the fact that singing is like the worst thing for C-word spreading. So it's unlikely that I'm going to be out singing for a very long time.
Is this because you spray spit everywhere? Not you personally.
It's because of that, and you breathe deeply into your lungs. And there have been some cases. There was a pretty grim concert in Amsterdam that one of my friends was singing in that's now suddenly making international headlines, where 110 of the 130 singers were infected from that one concert.
Wow, that is impressive and sad. I'm sorry to hear that. You might have to become a full-time podcaster.
I think I will. So please sign up to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Who are we speaking to today, Katie?
We are going to be talking about a rather intriguing mystery that has been bugging the Norwegian journalist Thomas Nilsen for months now. We're going to be talking to him about a disastrous fire on board a very advanced Russian submarine and what exactly that submarine might have been doing off the coast of Norway when it caught fire last year. So stay tuned for that. But first, as always... Who has had a bad week, Dominic?
I can happily pronounce that it has been a bad week for homophobes in Germany after a new law was passed that banned the practicing of gay conversion therapy to minors across the country. Under the new law, anyone found to be offering this service to anyone under 18 could be charged with up to a year in jail or a fine of up to 30,000 euros. This is obviously very good news for children in Germany, as it is usually their parents or guardians who make them attend these clinics, and the harm caused by this process can be enormous. I should say, those parents and guardians could now also find themselves punished by the state if they make their child go through one of these awful processes. Hmm. Whilst there haven't been any scientific studies proving that conversion, in inverted commas, is possible, there have been scientific studies that have shown that this so-called therapy can lead to a significantly higher risk of suicide and depression. So the law is very welcome and has received a broad coalition of support in Germany, although some think that it doesn't go quite far enough. The Green Party in Germany thought that the age limit for this kind of therapy shouldn't be 18, but should be 26, which seems to me like a sensible option, seeing as so many continue to struggle with their sexuality well into their 20s.
How many people undergo this therapy, for want of a better word, every year in Germany, roughly?
Well, according to the Magnus Hirschfeld Foundation, around 1,000 people are subjected to this awful practice in Germany each year.
It's quite a lot.
It is quite a lot. And I didn't see a breakdown of how many of them were under 18, so I don't know exactly how many people this legislation is going to help, but it's certainly a good step in the victory against homophobic and transphobic values.
This obviously isn't a problem that is happening just in Germany, right? This is everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a problem that's exclusive to Germany. There have been some pretty awful exposés of gay conversion clinics across the world and across Europe. I read some pretty awful stories about specific cases in Europe. For example, there's a church in Liverpool in the UK where they were using starvation as a method of conversion. Ugh. And there was also a grueling expose in the Spanish paper El Diario last year, which outlined a conversion practice in a branch of the Roman Catholic Church. You may be surprised to hear that this law in Germany is even news, because, yeah, I think many people assume that gay conversion therapy was outlawed long ago.
Yeah.
That's not the case, sadly. And in most countries, the law still isn't strong enough. There are some good examples in the continent. Malta was the first EU country to pass a law on this issue back in 2016.
Ah, quite a surprising... Like, you wouldn't expect it to be Malta.
Well, Malta's actually a really great place for LGBTQ rights. It's like a world leader. And their law punishes anyone who tried to change, repress, or eliminate a person's sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. Parts of Spain also have a similar law, but not the whole country. And Switzerland also has a de facto ban on the practice. Ireland also had a bill that passed a second reading in 2018, but didn't quite manage to make its way into law as of yet. There are dozens of psychiatric and medical bodies across the continent who have condemned this practice. The European Parliament also voted overwhelmingly in support of a motion to condemn the practice, urging member states to pass legislation accordingly. But most countries have been pretty slow to move. So that's why it warrants talking about the fact that this law has come in Germany. And kudos to Germany for putting this law through and giving the homophobes a bad week.
Nice one, Germany.
You know, I once worked in a Catholic church in London singing just before I moved to Amsterdam, so like 5 years ago. And they had posters up behind the scenes in the place where we got change saying, "Are you struggling with same-sex feelings? Get in touch
Wow.
with us, call us and we'll help you." And it made me so angry. And I mean, I knew that this existed, but I'd never seen it like promoted in this way. And I found it so upsetting. I think I did a really pathetic protest and I like took out the pins and turned the poster around. I think that was my way of processing. And I also quit, but I was leaving anyway.
That's very quietly powerful, Dominic. Well done.
Thank you. And it also seemed particularly mad seeing as like almost every man that worked in the church was clearly gay. Yeah, I mean, it's not a problem that's exclusive to the Catholic Church, but it does seem to have been a problem in that institution, sadly.
Grim.
Anyway, who's had a good week?
I'm giving good week to Finland this week, and that is because we now have the final results back from the country's much-hyped experiment with Universal Basic Income, or UBI. Before we go on, I'm going to make you do some of my work for me. Can you tell me, Dominic, what the Universal Basic Income is?
Oh, you're so mean. It's basically a system whereby the government would give every citizen like a monthly payout, not dependent on how much they work or didn't work or how much they earned. Everyone would get the same amount.
Yeah.
The idea is that it would create a more equal society, happier citizens.
Yeah, that's basically it. One thing for the kind of purists who promote this is that for it to be a full basic income, the money should be enough to cover like people's basic living expenses, so rent and food and stuff like that. People who are fans of this idea say that this would basically end poverty. And fans of the UBI in general argue that while it would obviously be hugely expensive, so you'd need to have pretty high taxes, the admin costs of running this would be way cheaper than how we currently organise unemployment benefits, which is really complicated and bureaucratic. So there's been a lot of buzz around this idea for the last few years. And because of that, Finland decided in 2017 to launch a massive experiment. It became the first government to organise and pay for a UBI experiment on a national scale. For 2 years, 2,000 unemployed people were chosen at random to receive a monthly payment of 560 euros. No strings attached, so they didn't have to prove that they were looking for work, and they didn't stop receiving the money if they actually found a job. A couple of caveats. Obviously, what they did in Finland can't be described as a full basic income, because obviously 560 euros a month isn't enough to live on. And also, this wasn't really universal, because all of the people who got the money were active job seekers.
I was going to say.
So, yeah, it wasn't quite UBI, but this is still the biggest and best experiment that there's been with this quite revolutionary idea.
And what were the results then?
So I would say the results were a bit mixed, but tentatively pretty good, actually. So the main thing that was obvious is that people who got this payment were happier, which I guess is not surprising. I mean, I'm sure you would like to be handed a cheque for 560 euros a month.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, this is kind of happening in the Netherlands right now for self-employed people.
Right.
Because of the C word, yeah. Although the horrible thing about it is that they said when they announced it, they were like, yeah, this is going to be for everyone self-employed, and there's going to be no checks on how much savings you have or anything. Everyone's just going to get it that's been self-employed. And then when you actually receive it, there's a letter saying, this is provisional. We can ask for it back at any time.
Oh, wow.
And we will be checking that you're actually eligible for this. So it's kind of mixed messaging.
Yeah, in Finland, the researchers did loads of in-depth interviews with people to find out what the impact of it was, and they compared them to a big control group of people that had stayed on normal unemployment benefits. And probably not surprisingly, the people that got the UBI had better mental health, better sense of security, and generally were more satisfied with life and just felt better about everything. They also, interestingly, ended up working a little bit more than people on normal unemployment benefits. And that's quite a win for fans of UBI, because the critics often say, if you give people money with no strings attached, everyone will just like become really lazy and not bother looking for work. And that didn't really happen here. The people who got the UBI worked 6 days longer over the course of a year than people who'd stayed on the benefits where you lose the money if you don't look for a job. Like I say, this money wasn't enough for people to live on. So maybe if people were getting like, I don't know, 2,000 euros a month, you might see very different results. But there did seem to be a bunch of interesting effects of these payouts. Some people said that they were able to launch businesses of their own that they've been wanting to do for ages. Quite a lot of people took on voluntary work because they had time to give back to society in other ways.
That's really nice.
Some people took on low-paid jobs that they wouldn't have done otherwise because they had that little financial cushion that made the job kind of doable. But other people did the opposite. And when they were offered a job that didn't pay much, they were able to say, like, you can stuff your low-paid crappy job. I don't need it. So I think it kind of just encouraged people to have the freedom to choose a lot more.
And I guess that's one of the criticisms as well, that no one would want to do the really horrible jobs for society.
Yeah, I suppose that is an issue. But then maybe we should get a UBI expert on this show, actually, to explain this so that I don't have to do it.
But, I've actually been thinking about that for a long time. We should speak to Rutger Bregman.
Oh, yeah.
He's the Dutch historian who talks about basic income a lot. It actually seems like there are some other possibilities of it taking off in Europe at the moment with, I think, Spain are planning some kind of UBI, aren't they?
Well, I don't know. I feel like what is happening in Spain it's a bit misleading to talk about it as a UBI, and people are, because it sounds sexy and people are getting excited about it. But they're bringing in something called a minimum vital income for the poorest households. But again, like it's means tested, so it doesn't really feel like a UBI. It feels much more like a traditional welfare benefit.
Mm.
But yeah, you're right to say that people are kind of watching this closely because the C-word crisis has, well, I mean, we're about to head into a massive and really grim recession. That much is clear. And even the Pope said last week that he quite liked the idea of a universal basic income. And it's getting picked up in other countries too. So Scotland is kind of interested in it. In Germany, there was a UBI proposal put to the Bundestag, but the Conservatives are against it. So let's face it, it ain't going to happen. I mean, realistically, I don't think we're going to see a European government introduce a genuine universal basic income for quite some time. But I mean, watch this space. There are a lot of things that seemed crazy a few months ago, like shutting down the entire economy. And this idea is one of those ideas that just doesn't seem as radical or as fringe as it used to.
Did you know that Nixon almost went for a basic income in the US in 1969?
What?
I know. Isn't that so unlikely? Anyway, yeah, the person who talks about that is, again, Rutger Bregman in his book Utopia for Realists, which we should all read. I actually haven't read it all yet. But yeah, it's a really interesting story that he was really nearly going for it.
Wow.
Imagine what a different country it would be now. On the 1st of July 2019, some Russian fishermen were sitting in a boat, illegally fishing in a restricted area north of the Arctic Circle, not far from Norwegian waters, when suddenly a huge submarine emerged in the water in front of them, and there was this frantic activity as crew members emerged on deck. What they were witnessing was a Russian submarine emerging from a secretive mission that had gone terribly wrong. The sub they saw emerged was the mothership to a smaller, more extraordinary submarine, one that can scale to depths of the ocean that we think no other manned submarine is able to go. And that submarine, the Losharik, had suffered a terrible disaster, a fire that killed 14 sailors on board. Katie and I find out about this story because there was an amazing piece of reporting in the New York Times about the disaster containing some pretty wild ideas as to what the submarine might have been doing down there. We called up one of the reporters on this piece, the Norwegian journalist Thomas Nielsen, to find out more. I was wondering if we could start by talking about the submarine itself. Losharik, what do we know about the features and capabilities that make this such an extraordinary submarine?
We actually don't know that much. This is likely Russia's most secret submarine. But some information we have managed to get out from different sources in Russia and internationally. The Losharik is a one-of-a-kind submarine. It's unique. It's built in titanium. That means that the hull of the submarine is much stronger than other Navy submarines, that be Russian, British, American submarines. Having a stronger hull, this submarine can dive much, much deeper into the world oceans than any other manned submarines. And it survives the high pressure on the deep ocean seabeds.
And in terms of why it might be useful to be able to dive that deep, especially in this part of the world, in these seas, what is down there exactly that might be so strategically interesting or valuable?
Well, official Russian information and the information from the Russian Navy says that this submarine is used to do geological research on the Arctic seabed. And that's correct. They did so a few years ago, studying the Arctic continental shelf, where Russia hoped to find oil, gas, minerals, so that can bring good economy to the country for the future. But of course, this submarine was not designed only to do geological research. This is a submarine that has military capabilities, either it's spy activities on the seafloor or working on military installations. We know that they have listening devices, listening to enemy submarines. It can also maybe do sabotage on other countries' subsea installations. But the last, we know very, very little about.
And from your article, I understand that there's also been some suggestions that maybe they were searching the bottom of the seabed for fiber optic internet cables.
Russia has a special division where this submarine belongs to under the Ministry of Defense. It's called the Directorate of Deep Sea Diving, or the GUGI. It has a fleet of vessels that have actually been sailing the North Atlantic over to the coast of North America. They are sailing and they are stopping exactly over the most important internet cables that are crossing the North Atlantic between Europe and the United States, between Great Britain or the British Islands and the United States. What is also interesting is the feature of the Loscherik submarine. You can describe it as arms that are coming out of the nose of the submarine, making it able to work on the seabed. And these arms have tools that are designed also to possible cut internet cables. Many of those people we were talking to described it as a kind of the Russia's new way of thinking of warfare. It might be that Russia are able to cut the internet cables, and by that they are cutting communications. Either it's civilian ones on the fiber optic internet or military subsea sea cables, and will give Russia an advantage up front of a potential military conflict.
This submarine suffered a huge disaster in July of last year. What do we know about what happened on the 1st of July?
It started a fire in the battery compartment of this submarine. Something went very, very bad with the submarine when it was working on some kind of secret mission. And what we do know, and what is so scary about this story, is that they did actually have a possibility to evacuate the crew from the submarine. But in Russia, goal number one is to make the survival of the submarine. So the crew were ordered to fight the fire, to stop it in order to save this very expensive and unique submarine. And that was the disaster, because when the air went out, all 14 crew members on board died.
And these were very senior crew members on board the submarine, right? Like, there were some very decorated officers down there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. These were highly decorated officers with many, many years of experience working on different kind of submarines. And what seems is that there are only highly decorated officers that in the first place would be allowed to work on this very unique submarine. This submarine reports directly to the Ministry of Defense in Moscow. So this is as high placed up as you are possible to get in any kind of submarine.
Lots of people didn't want to talk to you for this report. The American Navy didn't want to talk about it. Norwegian Chief of Defense didn't want to talk about it. Do you still feel like you have more questions about this disaster than answers?
We have one main question again, and that is, of course, what exactly was the submarine doing at the time of the accident? We know that what the submarine is designed to be able to do, but what exactly was it doing is still an unanswered question. But of course, this is like all other military top secret operations. It is very, very difficult to get someone inside Russia to talk about it. And of course, NATO countries like Norway, United States, Great Britain, they don't want to give information to the public about what they knew, because that will probably compromise some of their way of doing intelligence work.
That said, have there been any signs of any response from the NATO countries in terms of their own submarine operations or Navy operations?
For Norway as such, Norway don't have any such kind of submarines. The United States Navy does neither have deep diving submarines with a crew that can work on the seafloor. But I have a kind of impression that the United States Navy have drones that can dive pretty deep and also do work on the deep seafloor. But again, these are information that Navy and military officials don't like to talk about.
if you are interested in Russia's activities in this part of the world, you should definitely check out the website of which Thomas is editor, the Barents Observer. We'll post a link in the show notes. And you should read his New York Times investigation as well. It is really fascinating reading. What else have you been reading or generally consuming this week, Dominic?
I binged on a new sitcom on Apple TV. I don't feel like I should be. I shouldn't be giving them a shout out. They don't need any help probably right now. But I did the trial, so I didn't actually pay them anything. It's a British sitcom called Trying, and it's about a 30-something couple trying to adopt a baby. And I found it really charming, and it made me feel really nostalgic about London. As a Londoner who's not in London at the moment and not able to be there, it paints a like annoyingly perfect vision of North London, and specifically the part of the world that I used to live in. But it shows these beautiful houses that only multimillionaires can live in these days, and there's just like an ordinary couple living in it. So that's annoying, but it's really charming, and Imelda Staunton is amazing in it as a social worker.
I love her. She's one of the most famous people I've ever seen on the underground.
You saw her on the underground? Yep. That's nice, she uses the underground.
Reading the Evening Standard newspaper.
Oh, Imelda. What about you? What have you enjoyed?
I've got a practical one for you this week. I've been sleeping quite badly of late. I think lots of people have. But I've recently rediscovered a foolproof way to drift off to sleep. And that is to listen to the 1954 recording of Under Milk Wood.
Oh, yeah.
The radio play by the great Welsh poet Dylan Thomas. Oh, it's so nice. It's read by Richard Burton, the formidable Welsh actor. I don't know if you've known the story at all, Dominic, but you basically find yourself soaring over a Welsh fishing village at night and like sneaking into the dreams of all the villagers.
Only you can hear the houses sleeping in the streets in the slow, deep, salt and silent, black, bandaged night.
Richard Burton just has such an incredible voice, and it is just magic. Honestly, when I put this on YouTube, I'm asleep in approximately 5 minutes, which is a shame because I miss most of the story, but I get a little bit further every time.
Sounds great. For my happy ending, I wanted to talk about a lovely craze that is spreading across the continent as fast as the weeds grow in your garden. It all started in France, where people began the friendliest graffiti trend there ever has been. People began to write the names of plants using chalk on the street, circling the plant and labeling the species, then sharing photos of their labeling on the internet. So someone would spot some daisies growing between two paving stones and label it Daisy with an arrow pointing towards it.
Oh, yeah. I think I read about this. It started in the south of France, I think.
Yeah, it started in Toulouse. And there's something very simple and charming about this idea. And it's taken off across the whole of France. And it's become huge in the UK as well. So look out for them on your walks out and about. But I will say, if you're in the UK, be careful. Because in the UK, it's actually illegal to chalk on the street.
Is it?
Yeah, apparently it is. Even to do like hopscotch is illegal.
So sweet little 9-year-olds could get arrested for doing hopscotch.
Absolutely. I think it would be pretty bad form if any police force actually decided to prosecute someone for writing the name of a weed in chalk on the ground, or a child doing hopscotch, but you never know. But I love it because it has an ability to make us more aware of the plants that we would otherwise ignore, and it makes us appreciate those plants that in the past we might have thought of as just a nuisance. And there does seem to be a shift happening around wild plants, as we all realise how important they are for biodiversity. And perhaps one of the reasons why this trend started in France is because they actually banned pesticide use in public space in 2017 and more recently in gardens in 2019. So there are many more weeds around than there were before. Did you actually notice that, Katie?
I can't say I had done, but I am noticing plants a lot more. I keep stopping to smell flowers. It's a new pleasure that I'm taking on my daily permitted government-mandated walks.
And wouldn't it be nice if you knew the name of what that every flower you were smelling was?
It would be nice. I heard there was an app for it, but this is a much more charming solution.
Yeah, one of my favourite examples of it was from this tweet that actually got 19,000 retweets. And it was a photo of a few of these examples that a woman had seen in Walthamstow. And she wrote, "To whomever is chalking names and descriptions of trees on the pavements across Walthamstow, I love you. This made my heart sing today."
Oh.
And actually in those photos, there was one that this person who was chalking was actually also writing little facts about the plants. They were writing like, "London pine, my favorite, takes pollution out of the air."
Hmm.
It's a lovely thing and made me happy.
Something very exciting happened this week, which is that we're now on Wikipedia.
We are. We've made it.
We're famous now.
Many thanks to one of our lovely listeners for making this happening. You know who you are.
So, yeah, you can check us out on our new Wikipedia page, as well as all of the usual social media websites if you're bored on the internet this week. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, Facebook, just type in the Europeans Podcast. And is there another one? Oh, yeah, you can email us if you fancy it. Hello@EuropeansPodcast.com.
We'll be back next week with an interview, actually, that's kind of about Wikipedia. So tune in next Wednesday. And in the meantime, stay safe, have a good week. And
maybe see you on the quiz.
Don't forget.
Bye.